Believe me.
We have 11 or more.
Representative Barr, have you had a chance to look at the minutes? There we go. Members, we will call this meeting of the House Commerce Committee to order. It's now 3 o'clock. Representative Barr, have you had a chance to look at the minutes from yesterday's meeting?
Yes, I have, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Barr will move those minutes. Any questions, comments, concerns, or corrections, members? Seeing none, those in favor of the adoption of the minutes from yesterday, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Thank you, Representative Anderson. We adopted those minutes. With that, Representative Knobloch, you are first up today. I will move House File 3384 for Representative Knobloch, and the motion will be that we send this bill to the Committee on Taxation. With that, Representative Knobloch, welcome to the committee. Please start whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House File 3384 expands the sales tax exemption that exists in state law for festival and fair prizes to also exempt items purchased for use as prizes in connection with charitable gambling. It also exempts from sales tax the lease or purchase of charitable gambling equipment and related supplies like pull tabs and bingo cards. Minnesota has an unusual tax law in regard to charitable gambling, as many of you probably know. The money that is left over after all expenses and taxes are paid goes 100% to charitable activities, yet we tax charitable gambling at a higher rate than any other organization of which I am aware. This bill would lessen the taxation by exempting the items mentioned from the sales tax. It is estimated this would cost and would save these organizations in the neighborhood of $5 million per year in total, and that money would then be available to other charities in our communities. So members, Mr. Chair, I'd appreciate your support, and I have with me John Grell from Triple Crown Gaming in St. Cloud to testify in support of the bill.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Please identify yourself on the tape and proceed when you're ready.
John Grell, president of Triple Crown Gaming Incorporated, St. Cloud.
Go ahead.
Please proceed. We're just asking you to support this bill for all the nonprofits that are in charitable gambling so that they would have more funds for their bottom line to donate back to their local communities.
That sounds good to me. Is there anyone in the audience that wants to speak for or against this bill? Anyone else? Members, any questions? Not seeing any. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 3384 be referred to the Committee on Taxation. Those in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, gentlemen. You're on your way to tax.
Members.
Representative Bliss. There he is. I thought I saw him here. I just saw a plaid vest, and I assumed that was you. Representative Bliss, I will move House File 3018 so it is before the committee, with the motion being that it goes to the Committee on Government Operations. Representative Bliss, welcome to the committee to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have an amendment I'd like to offer.
That's the 669 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, I apologize. It's stuck to the bill. I will offer the A18-0669 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like it to be in. Those in favor of the adoption of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, members. Representative Bliss, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. HF 3018 will create a task force to study charitable gambling taxation in Minnesota. I'm sure each of you have an organization in your district that does charitable gambling and donates those proceeds to the local community. As you've heard earlier, there's an issue with the amount that these organizations pay in taxes. This bill will set up a task force with legislators and stakeholders to drill down into the data and bring recommendations to us for the next budget cycle so we can make informed decisions on their tax policy. With me today is Al Lund, Executive Director for Allied Charities, to give you a brief testimony and help answer questions that you may have.
Thank you, Representative Lewis. Welcome back to the committee, Mr. Lund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Alan Lund. I'm the Executive Director of Allied Charities in Minnesota. We're the 501c6 that represents the gaming charities in Minnesota. The charitable gaming has been part of Minnesota since we started playing bingo in church basements 73 years ago. All across the state, police, fire, veteran, fraternal, youth, community organizations contribute to their local areas with charitable gaming donations. The current combined receipts tax structure was enacted in 2012, and the world and our industry has changed significantly since that time. To ensure the long-term viability of charitable gaming and to make sure the legislature has all the necessary facts to have an informed discussion on our tax structure, we are asking for you to support the task force to evaluate the current tax structure. This is a critical step to ensure the robust and thoughtful discussion of our industry and make sure these organizations can continue to give back to their communities. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lund. Members, any questions? Is there anybody else in the audience that wants to speak for or against the bill?
Okay, I apologize.
Representative Smith.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I have an amendment, the A1, that I'd like to offer.
Go ahead and speak to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'd like to have a testifier speak to this briefly, if he could, Mr. Chair, but the amendment deals with adding paddle wheels to this bill that I'm a co-author of. That's a great bill.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Sir, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Jim Probst, and I'm with the South Robert Street Business Association, and we're a group of business people that have charitable gambling around the West St. Paul area. We have a total of 15 locations, and we are running the tri-wheel now in one of our locations, and we're going to be starting it in a new location actually later on this week. We run it at the New Bohemian in St. Paul next to the XL Center. It's a great opportunity for us to go ahead and raise some more dollars for our community. Last year, we paid over $494,000 in taxes and fees to the state, and we were able to give away $200,000 to our community. Everything from Boy Scouts to the Henry Sibley Dollars for Scholars program, where we gave $20,000 and gave out 40 scholarships to kids in that school. And let me tell you, nothing is as satisfying as giving 40 kids scholarships. With the advance of the tri-wheel, it would hopefully be able to gain us more dollars. And that's truly what it's all about, is getting more dollars so we can help our community.
Thank you, Mr. Probst. Members, questions to the amendment? Representative Smith.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to pull the amendment, please.
Representative Smith will withdraw the A1 amendment. Mr. Probst, thank you for your testimony on it. Thank you, Representative Smith. And with that, unless anybody has a final question, I will renew my motion that House File 3018 be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. Those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. You are on your way to GovOps.
Thank you,
Representative Bliss. Representative Anderson. Representative Anderson, welcome to the committee. I will move House File 3523, so the bill is in front of the committee. And with that, Representative Anderson, start whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
I forgot to do this. The motion is to send this to the General Register. Sorry, Representative Anderson, please go ahead.
Thanks again for the chance to be here today and to discuss another bill with you. This one is kind of a culmination of a 50-year effort with the biodiesel in the state of Minnesota. This began back in the early 2000s, beginning with the B2 blend, then up to B5 and B10, and now we'll make that final step up to B20 in the summer months, beginning on May 1st of this year. And Mr. Chair, what my bill does, it has a couple of changes, actually a couple of additions. It extends and makes permanent the number one diesel fuel exemption. And on page two, the top three lines, one, two, and three, we had some negotiations and some concern about the ramp up to B20 in the spring of every year. So through a good bit of compromise, we agreed on a step-up program that will allow the folks that blend the diesel fuel to have 2 weeks to blend up and get up to B20. So what the amendment, or the new language does, is that they'll go to B10 on April 1st and then ramp up to B20 by the 14th of April every year. The B20 is in effect beginning May 1st of this year, and then following that, it'll go into effect on April 1st of every year with the B20. And Mr. Chair, there's been in the Ag Committee earlier, somebody asked a question about the price of biodiesel compared to regular diesel. And I checked the rack prices in Minneapolis as of about 9 o'clock this morning. There's very little difference, straight diesel fuel in B5 and B10, less than a penny price difference between those three blends of diesel fuel. So that cost is very much the same. And that is my bill, Mr. Chairman.
That sounds good, Representative Anderson. Thank you. Members, any questions? And I'm not aware of anybody. Was there anyone else in the audience that wants to speak on this bill? Not seeing anybody coming down, I will renew my motion that House File 3523 be referred to the General Register. Those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Anderson.
Representative Scott.
I will move House File 3380 while you are getting ready. The motion will be that the bill go to the General Register. Representative Scott, welcome to the committee, and it looks like we have an A2 amendment. I assume that's an author's amendment that gets the bill in the shape you'd like it to be in.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
I will move the A2 amendment. Those in favor of its adoption signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Thank you. Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Scott, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I might, I also have an oral amendment, if that's okay, that would just delete some language on lines 2.17 through 2.19. It would be after the word agreement, after the period, strike that following sentence.
So on line 2.17, we're going to be striking everything from, in addition to late fees, a storage facility or owner may also charge the occupant the actual costs incurred as a result of rent collection or lien enforcement. That whole sentence we're deleting.
Yes. There's just some confusion about what that sentence meant, and so just for comfort, we're just going to take it out of there. And then also on line 2.4, the new language on that line, we would be deleting and collection costs.
So are you essentially we're deleting section 3 then from the bill?
No.
So it's just that line?
Just that phrase, yeah.
So we're deleting everything from comma, including the late fees and collection costs, that whole line?
No, on line 2.4.
Okay.
Just the words and collection costs.
Got it. Okay. Ms. Pompeo, you have the changes? Representative Slocum? Everybody good with the oral amendments? We will go ahead and vote on the adoption of that oral amendment or those oral amendments. Are those in favor of the adoption of those amendments? Signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Thank you, members. The oral amendments are adopted. Representative Scott, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 3380 relates to Minnesota's lien law for self-storage facilities and specifically seeks to clarify policies on online auctions and late fees. With more than 800 self-storage facilities in Minnesota, 90% of which are operated as small businesses, this bill represents an issue of importance to members of my community and communities across the state. Before I briefly review the proposal, I wanted to provide some background on the history of this area statute. Minnesota's self-storage lien law was originally developed 30 years ago, and it went largely untouched until 4 years ago, at which time extensive work was done with the various stakeholders to modernize the policies in a way that meets both the needs of consumers and the needs of storage facility owners. That proposal ultimately earned unanimous support from the legislature and has been in effect for the past 4 years. My proposal today is much more limited in scope than the previous overhaul and seeks to update two items within the lien law. First, in cases where a self-storage facility is authorized to sell abandoned property in an attempt to satisfy its lien, House File 3380 would give operators the option to hold auctions online instead of posting auctions at the storage facility. Current statute already allows for online sales, but is unclear whether an online auction may take place in lieu of an auction at the storage facility. The second piece of this proposal seeks to establish an industry-wide cap on late fees. The establishment of late fees in state statute provides several benefits to the self-storage industry and its tenants. For the consumer, it ensures everyone receives prescribed equitable treatment. For the businesses, it provides comfort that their late fee protocol is considered an acceptable business practice. Late fee standards can also help avoid unnecessary litigation. In the absence of late fees laws, suits have been brought as class actions as well as wrongful sale lawsuits due to allegations of unconscionable charges. The self-storage industry encourages this legislation because it wants a benchmark in order to comply. As you can see on the map that was handed out, 25 states have established late fees for the storage industry, and all except five have prescribed up to $20 or 20% of the monthly rent standard as reasonable and fair. However, based on feedback from stakeholders, I propose an author's amendment to reduce the cap in Minnesota to $15 or 15%, whichever is greater. This would position Minnesota as tied for second lowest fee cap in the country. The amendment also clarifies that only one late fee may be assessed per month, responding to a concern raised by legal aid. I would remind the committee that self-storage operators in Minnesota are already able to assess late fees, and the goal of this policy is strictly to provide guidance for the industry and avoid unnecessary litigation. It's my hope that this proposal can earn your support today, and I'll stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Scott. Mr. Elwood. Mr. Elwood, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. Want to thank Chair Scott and Mr. Briggs and his clients for making the amendments today. Appreciate it. Still have some concerns about the bill I'd like to articulate briefly. We still think the 15 is too high. Way too high. If you look at the results of what that would be, just, you know, if you look online and you see what some of these storage companies are charging for some of the smaller units, it's as low as $24. So just do the math, and what's 15, it would be 15% or $15, whichever is greater. So $15 against the $24 or $39 a month, it's still, you know, these are 25, 30, as much as 60 or 70% of the monthly fee would be at a late charge for the smaller units. And if you flip it around on the larger units, it would be 15% or $15, whichever is greater. 15% of that is a very large amount. Because 20 states actually have these, doesn't make it reasonable. The fact of the matter is that under its well-settled law, that late fees are neither to be coercive nor punitive. They are only to recover the time value of money lost for the period that you aren't paid the rent. And so if you had to borrow that money, I will say to you that I just looked up the prime rate as of today, and it's 4.5%. Also, I would draw your attention to the three statutes in Minnesota that cap late fees now. utility late fees under 325E02, I think, and that's at 1.5%. The rent-to-own statute, 325-something-or-other-F-something, is at 3%. And 504B-177, which is the landlord-tenant law, caps rental late fees in apartments at 8%. And our usury law, 334.01, is 8%. So even at 15, I think we're excessive. And I would just say that if you just, I have a quote from Jeffrey Greenberger, I found on the website. He is the general counsel for the Ohio and Kentucky Self-Storage Association. And here's what he says about late fees. A late fee occurs without you providing a service. It automatically assesses a charge without doing anything further to earn that charge. So we would respectfully ask that this late fee be dramatically reduced as we move forward in the process. The other problem that we have with the bill is the provision of collection costs being automatically collected as part of a contractual arrangement, as opposed to collecting them in court and recovering them in court under judicial action. We can find no other statute that would allow collection costs to be obtained in this manner. They would be unverified, potentially unreasonable, and there's no forum to determine whether the actual costs. Finally, I know this is not in the bill, and I know Chair Scott and the industry said we want to keep this narrow, but I would be remiss. We've been doing these storage bills since 2014, and each year I come back and say, in 2014, there was a major change in the statute. It used to be a sleepy little law from 1988, which was changed dramatically in 2014. It used to be under the purview of the Uniform Commercial Code. We moved everything into the storage lien law, and in our view, took away some serious consumer protections. One of the rationale was we need to modernize this law. We have to modernize it. The one thing that was not modernized at our request, which didn't happen, was that under the current law, even if you don't pay and even if you are locked out, you still have the right to go in and take your clothes and tools of the trade. There is a monetary cap to the value, however, of $50 that has not, less than $50, which has not been changed since 1988. We respectfully ask that as part of this final package, that be increased to a reasonable amount to reflect today's the inflation from 1988. And finally, you know, there are many people that use self-storage. Our clients are not the folks that are moving from the East to get a high-paying job at Honeywell. Our clients are clients who are victims of violence and people who are just down and out on their financial luck. And under current law, you can, under this new law, if you don't pay and you're unable to redeem your stuff, the storage facility can sell it and get the money, which is fine. But what they don't sell, they can and do throw away. Many of our clients, their entire life is in that storage unit and all their possessions. And not only is that bad enough, but after that, the facility can go to courts, conciliation court, and sue for the deficiency for somebody who obviously has no opportunity to pay. We sue it all the time in conciliation court. We have a conciliation court advice clinic, and we see these all the time. We would ask that a very narrow exception be made so that people with that are victims of domestic violence, victims of sexual assault, and anybody that would be coming to legal aid for service would be just don't sue them. Just take their stuff, sell it, and be done with it. So with that, I really appreciate your indulgence of the time, and happy to answer any questions, and happy to work with the folks as we go along.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Elwood, can you say again what the purpose of late fees? You said is not to coerce or to punish, but you said in the Minnesota law that it is for a purpose. Can you just say again what that is?
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pinto, sorry, I was speaking fast because I know Chair Hoppe likes brevity. It's well set of law. That late fees can be neither for punishment nor to coerce payment. It is simply to recover the time value of the lost money.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess if that's so, maybe I'll ask the bill's author, Chair Scott, just to comment on that. But then if it is true, just if there is a justification or what that might be for the $15 per month or 15%, because that does seem much higher than the time value of money given the other, given common interest rates.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Pinto. I'm representing the industry here, and they came to me with 2020. We had no hearing on that. We felt that was too high. So we did come down to where we'd be the second lowest in the country on these fees. And so I know as a landlord myself that I still have to make a mortgage payment, and very rarely do I get whatever the prime rate is on my loans. It's just not, that's not common. So there is a certain time value of money. If I have to make my mortgage payment and I haven't received payment from renters, as well as chasing them down for paying the rent, that's time and effort. I just want to make one thing clear, too, and I don't know if Mr. Elwood heard the oral amendment or not, but we did delete the section that he was concerned about regarding the corruption stuff. So we did meet him on that as well. So we're certainly willing to continue working on this as the bill moves forward. It still has, you know, we're trying to meet deadline here in the House, and as it moves forward in the Senate, we're certainly willing to continue to work with Mr. Elwood and all the stakeholders.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess I'm, because the prime rate would be much lower than a landlord could get access to for borrowing, but 15% seems significantly higher than the owner of a business would have. And so I'm just wondering, maybe it is from the industry representative, if there is a justification for that time value, because 15% seems a lot higher than the time value money would be on this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinot, my name is Amos Briggs with Lockridge Grindle now, and speaking on behalf of the Self Storage Association, thank you both Representative Scott for carrying this bill and Mr. Elwood for working with us and a number of members of the committee as well. To your question, the $15 figure on units under $100 is closer to but much often less than the actual carrying costs and lost opportunity costs incurred by the operator when a tenant doesn't pay on time, so that's where that figure has come from. The averages around the country for late fees tend to be in the $10 to $15 range, in spite of the fact that a number of states do cap it at 20. That's kind of the average of where these things are. The actual costs incurred for labor, carrying costs, and so on, differ from facility to facility, so it's difficult to say, you know, this precise, you know, this much for a piece of mail or this much time spent calling or emailing folks. But it's primarily on the efforts to secure late payment and the carrying costs and the lost opportunity on renting that unit. Most operators, I'm told, do make calls and send emails to track down late payments, though that is not successful very often.
Representative Scott?
Thank you, Representative Fowley. I just want to add, too, that the loan that I take out to have a rental property, I don't own these facilities, I own residential properties, but the loan I take out is usually in excess of, say, $100,000, and a loan that's at 7% at $100,000 is going to be cumulatively a larger amount than what, you know, the $15 that we may be charging here. So it would take a lot of smaller late fees to ever make up for, you know, if I was unable to make my mortgage payment and had my late fee assessed to me, if that makes sense. I don't know if I explained that well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I guess I'll just close this out. Presumably that larger loan that was taken out, though, is for a facility where a number of the other renters are, in fact, paying on time, and if they're not, then there will be a series of late fees being collected. I guess what I'm hearing, it sounds like this fee ends up kind of, from what the Mr. Briggs had to say, that it sort of is combining collection costs, carrying costs, time value of money of not having the funds paid in, and so it feels like it's combining a number of different things. So if it is the case that it should just be the time value of money, it feels like this is getting kind of broader, but perhaps it is something that's more appropriately broader. So I'll be done with it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Scott, what is the percentage of these units that go into default?
Representative Scott?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would defer to my testifier on that.
Mr. Briggs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenthal, I don't have that figure. I can certainly track that information down and get it to you.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Rosenthal?
That would be something that would be really helpful in determining what the right level of penalty would be, I would think.
I think this is a good time to thank the author and Mr. Elwood for working together, and Representative Scott, I think we all appreciate your willingness to continue working with Mr. Elwood, get Representative Rosenthal that information, and that makes things go easier when the author is willing to do that. Representative Rosenthal, you good? Representative Loon, did you have a question? No. Anybody else in the audience that wants to speak for or against this bill? Not seeing anybody, Representative Scott will give you the final word.
We just appreciate your support. Thank you for a good hearing.
Thank you, Representative Scott, and Mr. Elwood and Mr. Briggs. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 3380, as amended, be referred to the General Register. Those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion does prevail. It's on its way to the General Register. Thank you, everyone. Representative Peterson. Representative Peterson, welcome to the committee. I will move House File 3012, and the motion will be that it go to HHS Finance. Okay. Representative Peterson, just to double check, we have an A1 amendment. We are not offering that amendment. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
To your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're all looking for ways that we can control the ever-increasing cost of medications. House File 3012 tries to ensure that patients are not forced to pay too much for their drugs. It is hard for me to believe that we even need a bill like this, but it shows how the influences of some of these PBMs need to have some adjustments. So all the bill says is if it's cheaper for a patient to pay cash for a drug because the cash price is lower than the deductible copay for the patient if they use their benefit, the PBM cannot prohibit that through a contract with the pharmacist. So, for example, if your pharmacist says you have a $10 copay and you're assuming that the drug costs more than $10 and your insurance is covering the rest, but unbeknownst to you, the drug actually costs $7 and the PBM claws back the extra $3. Had you paid out of pocket, you would have gotten even a better deal. A recent University of Southern California study shows that customers overpaid for their prescriptions 23% of the time, totaling $135 million in just a six-month period. So, PBMs were designed to help save money in the system by negotiating lower costs, and I think that we have seen the good things that have come from PBMs as they've been around for a very long time. In fact, I really truly believe it's one of the reasons why Minnesota was a leader in this area and we became the lowest cost, highest quality healthcare system in the nation prior to ACA passage. But because this is an unregulated industry, we don't know where those savings go, which also includes manufacturer rebates. We do not know that because of their contracts and pharmacies that they're interfering with patients getting the drugs the prescribers and the pharmacists believe is best. And as this bill points out, PBMs in some cases are prohibiting patients from getting the recommended drug as the lowest cost available. It is practices like these that compromise patient care, causes patient stress, and makes our constituents furious. And we want our health costs to be lowered, and this is why we have this bill before you today, and I do have a testifier here today to also reiterate that.
Thank you, Representative Peterson. Sir, identify yourself for the record, and please proceed.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tim Gallagher. I'm a pharmacist from Northfield, Minnesota. I have been a pharmacist for 33 years, the last 24 years, working for A-Strip Drug and the Sterling Pharmacies based out of Austin, Minnesota. And we own and operate 22 pharmacies now in southern Minnesota. I come to you today not to speak on my behalf, not even to speak on behalf of my pharmacies, but to speak on behalf of consumers. to speak on behalf of my patients who are being taken advantage of, frankly, who are overpaying for prescriptions. And I think this bill does a lot to try to address that issue. So I'll try to make it as simple as I can. Several years ago, we noticed a phenomenon when we would process prescriptions. Typically, a patient would pay a copay, and then there was a contractual amount that the pharmacy would get paid. But usually, the copay didn't cover the entire amount, so there would be a balance due to the pharmacy. We started seeing patients' copays go up, and actually a negative amount due to the pharmacy, where actually the pharmacy benefit manager was what we call clawing back money from the pharmacy. So for example, a patient may pay a $40 copay, the pharmacy got reimbursed $25, and $15 got billed to the pharmacy and paid back to somebody, paid back to the pharmacy benefit manager, but nobody knows where it goes. Do they keep it? Does it go to the health plan? Nobody seems to really know. So this bill essentially would say that the patient always received the lowest price, whether that would be the cash price or that would be the contractual amount that the pharmacy got paid or the patient's typical copay. And that's all I ask. It's fairly simple. So.
Thank you, Mr. Gallagher. Members, any questions? Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Peterson. This actually happened to me. I was shocked. When I changed benefit providers, I drove up for my prescription, and I forgot my insurance, and they said, you owe X amount. I said, how much would it be with insurance? And it was considerably more, so thank you.
Thank you, Representative Rosenthal. We have another testifier who signed up, Ms. Abby Stoddard. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape and start whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Abby Stoddard. I am a pharmacist with Prime Therapeutics. Prime Therapeutics is a pharmacy benefits manager based in the metro area here. And I first do want to thank Representative Peterson for bringing this bill, and thank you for working with us on this bill. I am here today to testify in opposition, but before I get into that detail, I want to be very clear with all members of the committee that Prime members always pay the best price. If the copay is $10 and the cash price is $8, our members pay $8, period. There's nothing in our contracts that prevent pharmacists from discussing that with members. Representative Dean has a similar bill, not on pharmacy contracting, but on pharmacy communications, and we are not in opposition to that bill. We are in opposition to this bill as written because, well, it has been described as this bill allows the member to pay the lowest price, the cash price, or the copay. There's actually three clauses in there, and our issue is with clause two. It says they pay the lower of the cash price, the copay, or the allowable claim amount, which is what the pharmacy is reimbursed. Pharmacy reimbursement is, as the previous testifier stated, entirely contractual. Pharmacy reimbursement is not relevant to the consumer. I can tell you, as a pharmacist working in retail pharmacy, my patients only want to know about two prices, the cash price or their insurance price. Now, I testified on this in a previous hearing, but I want to be very clear with the USC study, also mentioned that maybe in your packets. If you read towards the bottom of that study specifically calls out that PBM reimbursement data was not included in the study, and that the only data in that study was retail price data from 2013 that was only available for a very short period of time from CMS and then withdrawn. I also want to be very clear that we are a regulated entity. I'm a URO and a TPA, and Prime, as being based here, holds multiple business licenses. We cannot do anything that raises costs for our clients. We cannot do anything that brings our clients out of compliance with the law. So with that, we will continue to work on this. But Clause 2 is a problem because while we are here to solve the problem for the consumer, I need the pharmacies to put aside their contractual issues to solve this consumer issue. And if they're not willing to do this, we are going to disagree. I think the other important thing to mention with pharmacy contracts, the previous testifier, I think, alluded to it, is that with pharmacy contract for reimbursement, oftentimes that contract isn't even with the PBM. It's with another third party called the PSAO, Pharmacy Services Administrative Organization. Just another layer of the pharmacy reimbursement onion, another layer removed from the consumer. So I'm here to answer any questions. I'm here to solve the issue for the consumer. I'm not here to conflate this issue with pharmacy contracting.
Thank you, Ms. Stoddard. Members, any questions? Representative Lunden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to the testifier, did you just say pharmacy reimbursement is not relevant to the consumer?
Ms. Stoddard.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I showed earlier a picture of what is printed on a prescription label at a Walgreens. And I used to work at Walgreens. I can tell you these are the only two numbers that members care about. They care about the retail price, and they care about their copay. They do not, I have never been asked as a pharmacist, hey, pharmacist, I'm paying you $6. How much are you buying this for from your wholesaler? How much are you getting from Blue Cross? How much are you going to get from this from health partners? No. The only two numbers that matter to the consumer are the ones that are available to them, the retail price and their copay.
Representative Woon.
Well, to the testifier, what I'm hearing more and more now is a sophistication of the consumer, in fact, finding out, well, what is the best value, what is the best option for purchasing these pharmaceuticals? And in that case, the pharmaceutical reimbursement does become relative, and I contend you are wrong that there's a third figure going, what is the least expensive way for me to purchase this same medication? This is a great bill, members. We want to support this.
Thank you, Representative Luna. Members, any other questions? Anyone else in the audience that wants to speak for or against the bill? With that, Representative Peterson, we'll give you the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I did want to publicly say that I am going to continue to work with all stakeholders to make sure that we can do the best thing that we can for people. And that is, one of those is transparency. And I will say that pharmacy can be very complicated, but I appreciate your support.
Thank you, Representative Peterson, for your willingness to continue working on this. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 3012 be re-referred to the Committee on HHS Finance. Those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. You are off to HHS Finance. Thank you, Representative Peterson and testifiers. Speaking of HHS Finance, Representative Dean. Representative Lunden, do you want to move House File 3024 since you are a co-author on it?
I would, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dean, welcome to the committee. Nice to have you here. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We're going to...
HHS Finance.
Yep.
Good luck there. I've heard the chair stop.
It's, it could go either way. This bill, I won't take up a lot of time talking about this bill because you covered a lot of it with Representative Peterson's bill. What this bill does very simply as a portion of that is it allows pharmacists to tell people when there is a cheaper price if they're overpaying for the prescription medications. It allows them to do that, and the testimony that we've heard in the past several years, that surprised me that they couldn't. In fact, it was one of those things that I really didn't believe was actually a fact, but it in fact is a fact. Talking to the pharmacists with their agreements that they have, this would allow them to tell them if there is a cheaper price. This morning I had an 8:15. I arrived at about 7 minutes to 8, so I went to White Castle. I ordered a sausage sandwich, a large coffee, and hash browns, and the gentleman informed me that if I ordered a number 11, I would save money. This would, if we had the same commerce rules in effect, it would prevent the gentleman at White Castle from telling me that. So it seems wrong, and I think we can do something about it.
Mr. Chair. Representative Swiedzinski.
To Representative Dean, just what would be the legacy costs of that?
Representative Dean.
About 10 pounds, I think.
Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dean, why did these gag rules, why do they exist to begin with? Why were they put in place to begin with?
Representative Dean.
I don't know the exact history around that, but the relationships with the providers and prescribers, with the PBMs and with the payers are around what's on their list, I would imagine, and I would imagine that they have an agreement that says that they can only talk about what that is. I'm just purely conjecture, but that's my best guess.
Representative Fenton, you're good. Members, any other questions? Anybody else in the audience that wants to speak for or against the bill? Not seeing anybody. Oh, we got somebody who wants to come down. Mr. Gallagher, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you. Actually, the last bill and this bill are kind of interrelated, so it is quite interesting. And who would guess that a pharmacist can't talk to their patients about the price of their prescriptions? And in fact, you know, I feel that as a pharmacist, I'm obligated to make sure that my patients get the most appropriate medication with the least number of side effects at the lowest, the most cost-effective product. I mean, this is what we talk about in healthcare these days, about having the best healthcare at the lowest cost, and we can't. You know, we're put in a position where we either have to tell a patient, I can't talk to you about your copay, or we talk to them about it, and then we risk getting kicked out of the network with the PBM. I just last night looked at a provider manual from a PBM, and they list certain things as confidential, one of which is talking about payment, copays, reimbursement to your patients. If you're found to be in violation or non-compliant, they can kick you out of their network, and you can't even reapply to the network for 5 years. So think about that. If you're in a community where you have one primary payer and a pharmacy's kicked out of the network for 5 years, you might as well just close the doors. So it's very simple. Allow us to talk to the patients about less expensive options, even if that includes paying cash for your prescriptions.
Thank you, Mr. Gallagher. Representative Dean, we'll give you the final word.
Appreciate your support.
With that, I like brevity in the final words. And with that, I will have Representative Lunin will renew his motion that House File 3024 be re-referred to the Committee on HHS Finance. Those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Bill is on its way. Thank you, members. Thank you, Representative Dean.
Thank you, members.
Representative Petersburg. House File, I will move House File 3463 so it is properly in front of this committee. And Representative Peterson, I've got an A5 amendment. Is that an author's amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, it certainly is.
And I will also move the A5 amendment in an effort to get the bill into the shape that the author would like it to be in. Those in favor of the adoption of the A5 signify by saying aye. Those opposed, same sign. The motion is prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Petersburg, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee, for hearing this bill. This is a bill that is attempting to deal with some of the side effects of the Minlars and in our inability to get it working yet at this point. So we're working diligently, but there are some things that we think we could do streamlining some of the issues. This is one of those, and I believe that the purview of this committee is probably most interested in Section 1. Is that correct, Mr. Chair?
I believe that is correct, Representative.
Correct. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so really this amendment that you have in front of you is really the only change to Section 1, and it refers to, if you can understand, automobiles are a large cost item, and with them, auto manufacturers as well as dealers are trying to sell them. And so there's a lot of promotions that go out on a regular basis, based upon time, based upon age, etc. And so some of those are given incentives to the dealer. Some of those are paid by the manufacturer. Some of them are just less cost that the manufacturer is going to charge to the dealer. But all of them are dependent upon the title moving forward from the dealer to the owner. And as you can imagine, when normally it would take a month, maybe 6 weeks for the title to transfer, now we're talking about 4, 5, and 6 months. Oftentimes the programs have been eliminated or done, and both the dealers and the auto manufacturers are kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place. Obviously, the manufacturers want to get as much money as they can. The auto dealers have already sold the car, and they're counting on some of those incentives. And so currently, the auto manufacturers are aware that there needs to be something because it's not the auto dealer's fault, and the auto dealers understand that as well. But this bill and this piece of legislation just kind of clarifies exactly how long and for what the chargebacks may or may not be done, and kind of codify what's happening with it. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I will just leave you to ask other questions.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Ms. Backus, come on up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Amber Backus here on behalf of the Minnesota Automobile Dealers Association and its 363 franchise new car and truck dealers in the state. We do appreciate Representative Petersburg bringing this bill forward to address some of the unintended consequences of MNLARS. We also appreciate the opportunity to work with the manufacturers through this provision. We first heard about this dealers being charged back for incentives they'd offered customers in October when a handful of dealers were sent invoices seeking the return of incentive payments. I understand the manufacturers made efforts to suppress those invoices from being generated, but in February, dozens of small rural dealers across the state received notice of chargebacks totaling anywhere from $40,000 to $80,000. These amounts could easily wipe out a rural dealer's annual profit. While most of the dealers had success in appealing the chargebacks, we don't want any of our members to end up in financial jeopardy because of flawed data generated by MNLARS. Based on the manufacturer's concerns of the bill as introduced in terms of its breadth and no sunset, we appreciate having the A5 come forward to tighten up the language as well as provide a sunset, but we still have a couple of concerns that are unresolved in terms of the A5 amendment. The two I will quickly touch on is that we would prefer to have a 45-day appeal process versus a 30, as the manufacturer who was generating these chargebacks had a 45-day timeline. And we also want to make sure that the documentation requested by the manufacturers is reasonable and not beyond the scope of that related to title and registration associated with MNLARS. So I hope we can continue to work with them through that. And again, I appreciate your time today and would be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Ms. Backus. Very nice. Ms. Neera, come on down. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sandy Neeran, Messerly and Kramer. I'm here on behalf of the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers, Trade Association of 12 of the biggest car manufacturers. And I am here to tell you that this provision doesn't truly need a legislative fix. When we heard last fall that this may be a problem for some dealers, when they testified in committees over the interim, I immediately called all the manufacturers. I explained to them what was happening here with MNLARS, and told them that we all had a lot of sympathy for the problems that they were facing with the MNLARS system, and to please not penalize them in any way for any fault of their if not submitting paperwork in proper course of events. All manufacturers agreed to do so. I'm not aware that anybody has been charged back due to the MNLARS situation. This is not occurring in any way, shape, or form. That being said, Representative Peterson asked us to work with him on language that we could live with on this, and we wanted to do so. And so the A5 amendment, which I scrambled to draft early this morning, it may not be perfect, but it was the best I could do very quickly, will address the concerns we have. It does put a sunset on it in hopes that the MNLARS system will be fixed within a few years, and it does put in some protections at least so that the dealers at least do have to give us some documentation that what they're failing to submit to us is due to the MNLARS system. But we are sympathetic. We are not charging back.
Thank you, Ms. Neeran. Representative Nagy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And sadly, my summer went away to the MNLARS issue along with Representative Petersburg and many others. And we heard from a lot of folks, both dealers and deputy registrars and others, that they were getting these notifications. So I have spoken to folks who have gotten the notifications, Ms. Neeran, and I would just ask that you continue to work with the author and the dealers, because it really is happening. We've heard testimony when we were in various hearings over the summer that people were getting these things. And, it's important that we minimize the impact of MNLARS. It's huge. And if this can be one way that we do that, we'd really appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Thank you, Ms. Nguyen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, procedurally what happens is they do receive a notice from the manufacturers when they fail to submit proper paperwork. And then there is an audit process that is put into place, and they have to submit paperwork to prove that their failure to submit and complete title transfer is due to MNLARS. So we do have to at least have some paperwork. And that's probably procedurally what you heard. I do think that a number of the dealers have gotten notices, but nobody actually has lost any money because of it.
Thank you, Ms. Nguyen. Members, any other questions? Anybody else in the audience that wants to speak for or against the bill? Representative Petersburg will give you the final word.
Just thank you. As you can see, there's a lot of just concern about MNLARS and a lot of people just unsure, and so we're all trying to do the best we can to protect each other as well, and this is an example of everybody working together. So I appreciate your support on this bill.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 3463, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Transportation Finance. Those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Representative Nash. Representative Nash, House File 3972, which is going to be the omnibus liquor bill for this year.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move that, and I do have an author's amendment, the DE2.
Representative Nash would also like to move the DE2 amendment to get the bill in the shape he'd like to be in. Those in favor of the adoption of the DE2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Nash, 2-year bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, we had a really good conversation yesterday about the items that are listed in this bill. Very bipartisan. We had a lot of things in here for folks from all over, members from all over the state. We have tried to create a bill that is palatable to everybody. We heard from everybody yesterday, so these are the items that are in there, and if we could have staff walk through the bill, that would be great.
Mr. Clinton, do you want to do that? Or would you be willing to do that, I should say?
If not, I can fake it. If you, no.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nash, members of the committee. So this is the 2018 Omnibus Liquor Bill. This is the DE2 amendment. There's only 9 sections here. This will be fairly brief. And we, as Representative Nash mentioned, this committee did hear all these bills yesterday. So section number 1 and 2, those are the provisions related to the brew and wine making on premises stores that allows those stores to provide tastings without having to get a separate license to do that. Section 3 is the intoxicating liquor off sale. It's a Sunday, the Sunday off sale hours bill that was heard, or similar to the one that was heard yesterday. There are a few changes to that. In the DE2 amendment, off sale hours are extended to 8 p.m. If Christmas Eve or New Year's Eve falls on a Sunday. In addition, the Sunday off sale hours are modified from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. to 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. So there's an extra hour added to the general Sunday sales off sale hours of sale. Next are all of the special liquor licenses. Section 4 is the off sale license authorization that allows Hubbard County to issue an off-sale license to the Akeley Township, to an exclusive liquor store in Akeley Township. Section 5 is the special license for the Caswell Regional Sporting Complex. Section 6 and 7 are 2 of the 3 special licenses for the City of Minneapolis. Section 8 is the special license for the City of Edina to issue a special license to a retailer at 6801 France, that's the Restoration Hardware special license. Finally, Section 9 is the last special license that authorizes the City of Minneapolis to issue an on-sale license for a business at 3753 Nicolette Avenue.
Thank you, Mr. Clayman. Representative Nash, to the bill as explained by Mr. Clayman.
Well, Mr. Chair, again, bill that we worked on yesterday. We heard a lot of testimony, a lot of member comment here in committee. I think it's a good bill and would ask for your support, but I believe there is an amendment
we do the amendment first, or?
I think we get a couple of questions from members, and then
sounds
we can
great.
Go to an amendment. And I'm not sure who was first, Representative Hillstrom and then Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So at this point, all the provisions that are in the bill are non-controversial. Is that correct?
Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, I believe that based on our conversations yesterday, that these included are non-controversial. I was here for the whole thing yesterday, and I don't remember anybody getting overly upset.
Thank you.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I remembered, so this is on page 2, section 3, just the Sunday sales time change. I had recalled, and I'm sorry, I'm trying to look this up, that the proposal had been to go from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. and shift up 1 hour at both ends to be 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., so to kind of keep that 7 hours. And I don't know if that's correct, because the way the bill is written is 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., so just add an additional hour, but maybe we can get some clarification on that.
Representative Pinto, that's all right. I think it is a change, and good catch on that. And I think the reason it's 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. is that was our original House position from when did we do Sunday sales last year? Early last year, whenever that was. So that was the original position in Representative Loon's bill.
And so, Mr. Chair, I just want to clarify then that the proposal from yesterday, so that is a change from the proposal from yesterday, just to add an additional hour of Sunday sales. I don't know if that changes folks' positions, but just to make sure that that is a creep of an additional hour for Sunday sales as compared to the bill we discussed yesterday.
I personally resent the use of the word creep, but I think you're correct, and I also think, and Mr. Klayman can, or Representative Nash can straighten this out, did we have the Christmas Day, New Year's Day language in yesterday? I know it was talked about, but I don't know if that was put in yesterday.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, okay. I did have that yesterday.
Thank you, Representative Nash. Okay. Representative Pinto.
I guess I'm just want to make sure that it's noted, just in terms of, because I know there was quite a bit of discussion when Sunday sales went through about exactly what the hours were, and I know that, and I'm relatively new to liquor issues, but it seems like often there's this issue of sort of where does the line get drawn and then when does it shift, and so this does seem like an example of a shifting of a line. It's, you know, it's 1 hour. I can definitely understand lots of justifications for doing it, but I just want to make sure that we are fully aware at each step of what's happening.
Good call, Representative Pinto. Thank you. Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, maybe my nonpartisan staff for my benefit and maybe the benefit of others. In the House Research Bill Summary, items 4 through 9 list specific addresses. So my question is that license given to the business or to that address? So if the business vacates that location, could someone else move into that location and still be permitted a license?
Mr. Klayman, you want me to? I'll answer and then he'll straighten me out. I think so. For example, when we work with the city of Minneapolis, it's given to the individual license holder, and the city wants to control who's getting the liquor license at that location. So yesterday, I don't recall who it was, but one of the folks that was getting the liquor license from Minneapolis, I asked them a question about was there somebody in there before. So whoever that was, running a cafe or a restaurant or a bar, if they went out of business, the city wants to know who the next license holder is going to be, so they have a vested interest in doing that, and that's why we have specific addresses for the city, but then it also goes by the business owner. Am I pretty accurate, Mr. Klayman? Thank you. Representative O'Driscoll.
Citizen Chair, not to prolong this, but having been involved in municipal government, sometimes addresses change, so I never ever had to ask this question again in committee. Doing the clarification on that. You seem to be on a roll, Mr. Chair, so if you want to take that one.
I'm sorry, what was the question about the principal?
Sometimes addresses change, so there could have been some remodeling and storefronts and different numbers and stuff that business might still physically be in that location, but the address might have changed. Just again, so I never have to ask that question again in committee, just one time for clarification.
And I think what happens, whether it's the city of Minneapolis or any of the other Mankato or North Mankato or Edina, the individual cities are pretty good at patrolling who has a liquor license and what the address is, and we're just granting them, I mean, these are exemptions to their normal liquor license statute. So, Mr. Klayman, if you want to chime in on that, you can. But
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, well, just to clarify, the license is issued to a person who holds the license for a particular premises. If the address changed, then there may be some question from the city as to whether they need to get, say, if it's a special law, do they need to amend the special law so that it applies to the new premises. So that would be more a question that the city attorney would probably have to decide for the city before they come to the legislature.
Any other questions, members? not seeing anybody. Is there anybody in the audience that wants to come down and speak for or against the bill? Not seeing anybody there either. Representative Nash will give you the final word.
Thanks so much.
Oh, I apologize, Representative Nash. I just saw Representative Kreisha.
Thank you. And, Mr. Chair, I have in front of me the A2 amendment, and out of respect for the peace and valley mentality that you've always pushed, I will be up front. I'm going to end up withdrawing this, but I'm going to speak to this and because I want to make sure we have some time to vet this. Members, you should look at the reports on the municipal liquor stores, and you should look closely at those numbers, because I think we're in the business of putting together good policy, and we're not in the business of teaching businesses how to be businesses, and we're certainly not in the business of teaching towns how to be businesses. If you look at the statute in here, we are creating a protectionist atmosphere where you can stop competition. You saw Representative Grosso's bill yesterday. We're going to end up fixing this through exemptions. Go look at the numbers, members. What we're doing here is, and I just want to share a couple of numbers. I want you to think about it, because I think these conversations are going to come back up, and I think that it's imperative of us as state legislators to look at good policy and what our role is. But there are 228 stores, $344 million in 2015. That was up 2.1% in gross sales from in 2016 there was $344 million. That was up 2.1% over 2015. However, in the same time, there was an 8.4% loss in profits. Okay? And despite 21 years of sales growth, over the past 5 years, there's been a fall of 16.4% in profits. Where are those that are making profits? Let's talk about those in a second. Those that are making profits, they're taking their profits and they're doing two things with them. They're insuring future inventories, and they're supplementing existing revenue sources in the city. Now, there are 44 municipalities that lost money. 45. Of those 44, they're in Greater Minnesota. And if they're losing money, guess where the money's coming from? They're supplementing it the other way. So think about that. We are putting Greater Minnesota towns in a position where they're upholding liquor stores, municipality liquor stores, and preventing competition, yet it's hurting them. Okay, you can beat yourself over the head with a baseball bat and tell yourself it feels good, but at some point it does hurt. The other thing to think about, those municipalities that are making money, that are transferring money into other areas, this is what they're not being used for. They're not funding kids' college funds. They're not funding health insurance for families and entrepreneurs. They're not helping start the next wave of business owners. Couple things to think about in this municipality's issue as well. We, with this piece and statute, we are putting cities in the position of managing businesses. Now, in the OLA, or I'm sorry, from the auditor's report, one of the things that they suggest to cities that, and I know this from example in County of Greater Minnesota, is the cities that are losing money through this, they tell them, you need to look at your pricing, you look at your market policies, look for theft, poor inventory control, and damaged inventory. In many of these cases, there is things going on behind the scenes that cities need to be aware of. And I hear, I have a couple cities now they're dealing with. They're wondering where these gaps are. They're trying to figure out what's going on. And there's suspicion the money's going out the back door as well as product. This is not the business government should be in. Lastly, I just want to bring this to your attention. The original intent of this law, Minnesota municipalities were originally authorized to own and operate liquor establishments as a means of controlling the sale of alcohol. I think we're big people now. So I'm going to withdraw this amendment, but I hope, well, in fact, I don't even hope, I will be back having this conversation, because this is just good. We got to look at this. This is not the way state policy should be. So with that, Representative Nash, thank you for indulging me. Representative Hoppe, thank you for letting me take a little bit of community time, but I think we have a problem to look at. With that, I'll withdraw my amendment.
Representative Kreisha, thank you for the conversation, and thank you for withdrawing the amendment in an effort to keep peace in the valley. And with that, Representative Nash will give you the final word.
Well, once again, thank you, and I will renew my motion to send 3972 to the General Register, I believe, Mr. Chair.
That is the motion. Representative Nash renews his motion to send House File 3972 as amended to the General Register. Those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, members. Thank you, Representative Nash. With that, we are on to Representative Howe. House File 2320. Representative Howe, welcome to the committee. I will move House File 2320 so it is in front of the committee. And I will say I had a conversation, I don't know when it was, earlier this year or late last year with Mr. Snow from the IBEW. And at the time, we were not thinking about having a hearing, but one of the reasons that we're doing this is to get the parties talking. I don't know where this bill goes from here, but Representative Howe and folks on the other side, I hope we're going to get together and talk about the issue after today. And I was a little startled when I found out it was IBEW Day. I thought it was, you guys said the coincidence of coming on Bemidji Day. So you're dressed like a lot of the folks from Bemidji today, which is kind of a nice thing to see. And with that, Representative Slocum wanted to ask for a roll call on the bill, so I wanted to get that on the record right away. With that, Representative Howe, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would like to offer the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like.
Okay, my apologies. I didn't know we had an A2.
Well, basically, members, the difference between the A1 and the A2 is basically there's some changes in law from last year, and the A2 just makes sure that it's engrossed properly and the changes are in the right place. So it's really technical in nature from the A1 to the A2, but that is what I was told from the revisor's office.
Okay. Representative Howe, give us a minute so people can take a look at this amendment. Michonne, do you want to run through this for members since it wasn't in the packets?
Chair members, Anna Shalom, House Research. The A2 amendment is the exact same content as the A1, except it, in the last year, we adopted gender-neutral language in the construction codes, and so the underlying statute, all mentions of journeyman have been changed to journey worker. Otherwise, the content should be exactly the same as the A1.
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair, it sounds like, just to clarify and make sure everyone's on the same page, that the amendment itself is just strictly technical, and once we adopt that, we can deal with the heart of the bill.
The difference between the A1 and the A2 is strictly technical. I just wanted to have it read because normally we have the amendments in the packet, and I just wanted to make sure everybody knew what it was before we adopt it and get it in the shape the author would like it to be in. With that, I will move the A2 amendment. Those in favor of its adoption signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, same sign.
No.
The motion prevails. The A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Howe, to your bill as adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, House File 2320 is a basically what we call pathway to electrical licensure bill. We all know there's a shortage of skilled labor in today's employment market. This bill aims to ease that shortage in the electrical employment market. It makes sure that the hours that employees are working under supervision get counted towards licensure. Right now, there's a gap there. It provides an opportunity for people to work in a good job at a good wage with a positive effect on their families and their community. This bill is about finding, training, and retaining employees in the electrical profession and growing the pool of licensed electricians. What it basically allows to happen is it allows an electrical contractor the opportunity to borrow employees from two sources. One, another licensed electrical contractor, and two, from an employment staffing agency. Otherwise, there is no difference. We're not changing anything to do with with apprenticeship training, staffing ratios, workers' compensation, unemployment, none of that changes. It all stays the same. To that, Mr. Chair, I just turn to my testifiers, and we'll go from there.
Mr. Sanger, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman and committee, thank you for letting me speak today. Thank Mr. Howell for bringing this bill forward for us. I'm the Vice President of Melrose Electric and the current President of the Minnesota Electrical Association. Minnesota Electrical Association.
Just so you know, for once again, if you could say your name for the tape, just to make sure we're all legal.
My name is Jason Sanger. Yep.
Thank you, sir.
The Minnesota Electrical Association is made up of approximately 300 contractors, 85% of which gross less than $1 million a year. Being a small business owner from rural Minnesota, this bill is very important to me and my peers. Currently, when we have schedules change, when you have an employee get hurt, such as a broken leg, and go out, if you have a five-person electrical shop, that can be very detrimental to you making your schedules, and we have no way to bring on someone to fill in that role on a temporary basis. The only way we'd be able to do that is to subcontract to another contractor. This can create the requirement for additional permits to be pulled on jobs. It can be confusing to owners to see multiple contractors out there. This law would bring us so that we would lease the employees from a staffing agency or another contractor, so they would all be working under one permit that the permit holder, which has to be a master electrician, would sign off, and he would say by signing off that permit, he'll follow the law. He will have the current ratios working on the site. The law covers workman's comp. It covers the independent contractor issues that you could potentially have with this. It also will help, I think, take stress off of people having families by having people laid off, having to work overtime by leasing them back and forth to other contractors when they need help or when they are slow. This bill is also a great way to expose people to the electrical industry that might not have the chance otherwise. A staffing agency might bring somebody in that can't afford school or for various reasons where they can't afford tuition or can't afford to take time off and not work, but it bring them in a supervised environment where they're under a licensed contractor that ensures their safety and OSHA regulations. It would ensure that they are being taught the electrical trade, ensure they have workman's comp, and they give them the option of possibly being hired on full time, entering an apprenticeship program, and being turning this temporary position into a career. Thank you for your time today.
Mr. Sanger, nice job. Thank you. Mr. Straczynski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Bill Straczynski, and I'm here today representing the interests of the Minnesota Electrical Association, and I've been working on this legislation for some time. It's important to understand that the sharing of electrical workers is a practice that's been going on in the industry since probably 1928, at least, thereabouts when the licensing laws first came in. Union contractors share workers through dispatching them through the union. The members come off the bench. The merit shop contractors, small electrical contractors, rural contractors, don't have a bench to get employees. So somebody breaks a leg, they borrow an employee or lease an employee from another contractor, or they get the temporary work agency or staffing agency. This bill, when the issue came up, what's happened now, unfortunately, is the law says the licensed individual and the unlicensed individual must be employed by the same employer. Therein lies the dilemma. So, in other words, you can't use somebody from a temporary agency, even though they might be a licensed journey worker you bring into your job for 3 weeks. You can't use them technically under the law because you're not the W-2 employer of that individual. That would be a simple fix, is to delete that bill from that language from the statute. But this bill, that was made a lot of people very uncomfortable. I spent a lot of time meeting with the people who have concerns about this bill, including the IBEW, NECA, and certainly the Department of Labor and Industry. So rather than just eliminating that sentence and causing concern by people, we've added back in all the requirements that are under current law. So you must have, person who comes to the job site must have workers' compensation on them, unemployment compensation. They must be supervised by a licensed individual, And the employer who pulled the permit must report those hours that that person worked in that to the Department of Labor and Industry, so those hours count towards that individual's license. That's not the current law now under these circumstances. And so we think we've addressed a lot of the concerns. I think it's become very tight, and this certainly provides an opportunity for Merichap contractors to continue to practice that provides us our employees to do jobs. There's competition for employees. Now, it's hard to get people to come into the marketplace, and you can't hire somebody for 3 weeks and then lay them off again. Nobody wants to be hired under that circumstance. But this provides us an opportunity to provide a good job for all those individuals as well. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Straczynski. Representative Nash has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Representative Howard, to the testifiers, yesterday I was talking with a constituent that talked about some safety concerns and that they have articulated them to you. Does this change in any way any exposure for the entry-level person that's going to come and work on one of these projects? Because I would like to know to make sure that I can get back to them appropriately to address their concerns.
Well, Representative Howell. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nash, they have the same supervision, the same safety workplaces, safety work rules are in place. So I don't see where it's that it's a safety concern at all. You still have trained supervision on those workers, and I'll let someone that's actually done it respond to you so you can hear from him.
Is that Mr. Straczynski?
No, I would say the electrical contractor is actually done.
Yeah, I thought that'd be funnier. Somebody else.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair. I would envision on this that the main person pulling the contract is still responsible for the people working under them. So they're responsible for providing PPE, personal protection equipment, verifying they follow the OSHA laws per their contract with a general contractor or with an owner. So even though the employee isn't their direct employee, they have some kind of leasing relationship with them, so they are still directly under them on the job site. They're responsible to make sure their electrical installation is correct. They're responsible to make sure the ratios of two unlicensed per one licensed electrical worker are enforced, and they're going to be responsible for any OSHA fines that come through that way, so it's their job to ensure the safety like their own employee.
Mr. Straczynski?
Mr. Chairman, members, Representative Nash, the bill requires that the work of the individual be performed according to Section 3.6B, which I think is the OSHA standard. I brought back in all of those provisions of the current law into this bill so that all those current requirements have to be met.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Nash?
Yeah, just a quick follow-up before we... just so that I understand it, safety equipment still has to be provided irrespective of whether they're directly or not directly working. And all of those, none of the provisions that would exist if they were a brand new worker have been changed, are being changed. Just want to make sure that I have that right, because I will have to go back and talk with my constituent, because I want to make sure that I close the loop on that.
Representative Howell?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, that's correct. Everything's the same.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Nash, I thought I might address some of that issue. Under current law, journeyman electricians or journey worker electricians and unlicensed individuals, apprentice electricians, must be an employee of the contractor that they are performing work for. This proposal language would allow journeyman electrician and unlicensed individuals, the apprentice electrician, to be employed by different employers than that of the contractor who was bonded, who's pulled the permit to perform the electrical work for the project. This new arrangement actually eliminates many of the consumer protections by undermining the clear connection of liability. And I asked the chair if this was going to civil law. It's going to jobs first, but ultimately if it ever makes it out of jobs, it's got to go to civil law, because under current statute, an electrical contractor is responsible for their employees' electrical installations, and when an installation is unsafe, the employer, the contractor, is required to make the inspections, to make the necessary corrections at no expense to the consumer. That's under current law. This puts the consumer in a really difficult spot if you're leasing an employee in terms of they hired one, there's someone else performing the work, there's mandatory safety corrections required, and what if they don't do it? You know, who do they sue? How does it work? What happens? I've never heard of such a thing of leasing employees. You don't lease people in Minnesota. And we have a lot of consumer protections under the law that this bill, as it states, puts people at terrible risk. So consumers at terrible risk. So I have more things to say, but I wanted to make it real clear that that your constituent question is not clearly addressed under the bill.
Representative Howe, and then we'll come back to Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And having been a building official for a long time, and I work with electrical inspector hand-in-hand on all the projects, the person that's responsible on those jobs is the permit holder. Whoever takes the permit out is required to do the work and do it correctly. That's who we hold accountable. So when I go out to a job site, I find something wrong, I write the correction notice. It goes to the permit holder. And that's who we will hold responsible. That's who would be liable if somebody did something wrong. The permit holder, the person that took the permit out to do the work, is the responsible party.
Representative Nash, did you? Okay. Thank you, Representative Howe, Representative Hillstrom. With that, I don't see anybody else that has a question right now. Why don't we? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Slocum. Remember I told you to throw something at me? Gotta get my attention, sorry.
Right. I'm throwing something at him. Just to kind of bring things up.
I'll do it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're very welcome, Representative Slocum.
I see this also as bad for consumer protections, bad for employees of electrical contractors, bad for good electrical contractors who seek to provide proper supervision, bad for the supervision and training of unlicensed individuals, and generally bad for the electrical industry in the state of Minnesota, the residents of the state of Minnesota. We all expect really high standards. We have high building standards, and we expect things to be done right and well. And this, I think, undermines both.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In regard to the consumer protections, the liability policy that a general contractor would have, a CGL policy, has several provisions in it. One provision is for what's called premises and operations, which covers for acts of the insured themselves and any employees. There's a second provision called owners and contractors, which covers, extends liability coverage for any acts of independent contractors or leased labor under that contract. The reason those two are separated, even though they're covered identically the same, is there's a different insurance premium charge because there's a different level of expected control over them. So the consumer protections are already in place as long as they have liability insurance, which I believe this bill does require along with workers' comp.
Thank you, Representative Lunan. With that, I think we'll have Mr. Snope and Ms. Moline come down. Not right now. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed when you're ready.
All right. Thank you, Chair Hoppe and representatives, for hearing my testimony today. My name is Andy Snope. I'm the Legislative Director of the IBW Minnesota State Council. The IBW State Council consists of 16 IBW local union business managers who represent about 16,000 members who work in the electrical industry in the state of Minnesota. I just want to let you know, too, that I've come from the industry. Before I started working as a Legislative Director, I worked in the industry for 22 years as an electrician. So some of this I understand how it affects us kind of in a personal way. This language significantly changes that employment relationship between licensed journeyman electricians, unlicensed individuals, and the contractors they work for. To expect one contractor to be responsible for the work of another contractor's employee is a recipe for disaster for the customer and the safety to the public. Under current law, the journeyman electrician and the unlicensed apprentice must be an employee of the contractor they are performing the work for. The proposed language allows the journeyman electrician and the unlicensed individual to be employed for different contractors, other than the person that maybe have pulled the permit to do the electrical work on the project. This new proposed arrangement would be detrimental to the consumer protections by undermining a clear connection of liability of the electrical contractor, the permit holder,
the individuals performing the work. It would be problematic to think that one contractor is going to fix the installation or safety violations of another contractor's employees. Under current state statute, electrical contractor is responsible for the employee's electrical installations. And when an installation is unsafe, the contractor is required by the inspector to make necessary corrections. At no expenses to the consumer, the installation should have been installed correctly the first time. This change would leave the consumer in a terrible spot of trying to figure out who's supposed to make the correction. The inspector or the consumer would have no way of finding out who the contractor is for the supervised employee or who the contractor is for the leased employee who performed work on the project if they are employed by a different contractor than the one that hired them and pulled the permit. No other licensed craft in the industry are unlicensed individuals allowed to be supervised by anyone other than a licensed individual working for the same employer. All the crafts, licensed craft in Minnesota, the elevator constructor, the plumber, and the high-pressure piping contractor, all have similar language of hierarchy of the contractor supervising the unlicensed and the licensed individual. All those organizations are opposing this bill. As well in your packet, we sent out a letter from the operating engineers, and just recently before we got to committee, I got a letter from the carpenters that also opposed this bill, and I have that to be handed out if Mr. Reynolds wants to take a look at it first.
You can just hand it out.
Just go ahead and hand it out. That's fine. Thank you, Mr. Snow. Under current law, an unlicensed individual receives the proper training and supervision required for an individual to learn the trade, earn the industry hours to test out and become a licensed journeyman and a master electrician. An unlicensed individual and a journeyman electrician working to obtain their master license must have their hours signed off by and accounted for by the employer they are working for. This proposed language changes that relationship and then attempts to correct it. However, it creates a real complicated situation if an employee is trying to go back and account for his hours and it isn't real sure who was supervising him at any given time during a project when he is loaned out to other contractors throughout his career. This proposed language is bad for consumer protections, bad for employees of electrical contractors, bad for good electrical contractors who seek to provide proper supervision, bad for the supervision and training of unlicensed individuals, and generally bad for the electrical industry in the state of Minnesota. The residents of the state of Minnesota expect high standards of skilled craftsmen in electrical industry. This bill undermines that expectation. Please oppose any changes to the standards that are now in place and oppose House File 2320. And I just wanted to add a couple comments. Representative Nash asked about some safety on the job site, and he was kind of told that those responsibilities would still be in place. And my question is, or where I think this is kind of foggy, is who's responsible? Is the person that loans out his employee, is he responsible for making sure that person has a hard hat or safety equipment? Or is the contractor he loaned the employee to responsible? It's not real clear. So if somebody shows up without the proper safety equipment and that contractor says, well, you know, your employer should have gave that to you before you came here, then is he going to be working safe, or is he going to be provided that equipment? So I have some concerns about that as well. Also, some of the testimony here tends to complicate it by pitting union against non-union, providing a list or a bench. There's nothing in state law that says that any contractor or group of contractors can't keep a list of people that are unemployed and draw off that list when they need help on a particular project. That concludes my testimony, and I really appreciate being allowed to speak today.
Anytime. Nicely done, Mr. Snow. Members, any questions? Otherwise, we'll go to Ms. Moline.
Welcome to the meeting.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. My name is Carly Moline. I'm here with the State Building Trades. It's good to see you all. Thank you for the opportunity to testify here today. The Minnesota State Building and Construction Trades Council represents over 70,000 members of trades unions statewide.
Representative Moline, Ms. Moline, how long have you had your new job?
It's my third week, Mr. Chairman.
Hang on one second.
Would that constitute freshmen?
I'm thinking treats.
I apologize, Mr. Chairman. I should have brought treats.
No, whatever. Well, you're doing fine. Sorry to interrupt, but...
We, on behalf of our affiliate unions and their membership, including IBEW, join in opposition to the bill that is before you. Both labor and management in the trades industry has a history of working toward a common goal of promoting safety of workers, proper training and supervision of employees, and delivering a quality end product. This partnership has served workers, contractors, and the public well. Current licensing reflects these common workplace goals. Unfortunately, the bill before you tips the scale too far in favor of benefiting the bottom line of the contractor and away from protecting the interests of the worker and assuring a quality end product. Current law provides the necessary safeguards for both the worker and the consumer. The proposed legislation could create confusion as to liability when an employee is working for someone other than the contractor who actually pulled the permit for the project. Changes to licensure requirements as proposed in this bill could also result in a lack of appropriate supervision of employees, which could in turn jeopardize the quality of an end product project. So again, on behalf of the State Building Trades Council and our affiliates and their members, we respectfully request that members oppose this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Mayor. And my apologies for kidding around. We do serious work here, but there's no reason we can't have fun while we're doing it. Members, any questions? Not seeing any. Thank you both. I'm sorry. Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Ms. Moline or Mr. Snopes, it's my understanding we want to train and hire as many new electrical workers, carpenters, or whatever they are. It's my understanding that you have a really good training program. Could you elaborate on that and how it works?
Mr. Snopes?
Sure. Chair Hoppe, Representative Rosenthal. Yes, that's true. The IBEW has several training facilities for electricians. Minneapolis, St. Paul, Rochester, and Duluth and Hibbing use a technical training center. I've sent out invitations to all of you to come to our facilities, and you're welcome to do that at any time. We're happy to show off what we have. All our training is done through no grants or no public money. It's done through the contributions through the wages that journeymen and apprentices make, as well as through the contractors that help fund those. It's a joint effort between contractors and electricians and people in the electrical industry, and it's a great program to bring people in. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Snow. With that, not seeing. Oh, Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a do you have a shortage of electricians? I mean, is that an industry where we have a workforce shortage currently?
Ooh, Mr. Snow? Chair Hoppe, Representative Fenton. No, I don't think we have a shortage. Other than, you know, the global industry as a whole, as we look at high schools and the promotion of trades, and it seems as though they've kind of switched to promoting college more than they have trades in recent times. So there is a worry that maybe at some point people may lose interest in getting in the trades. But right now we have a lot of workers in the trades, people seeking work. I think we're at a good balance right now. A few years ago, maybe after the Great Recession, a lot of people were unemployed. But our industry right now seems to be at an equal playing field of enough workers to provide for what we need out there. So we're not really seeing a shortage at this point.
Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sim, so, and you serve all, you are across the state of Minnesota, and there's no difference, maybe a shortage in greater Minnesota, where you have a plethora here in the city, or in the cities?
Well, I think maybe in greater Minnesota there's a real, I'm sorry, Chair Hoppe, Representative Fenton. I think there's a real shortage of work, say, up on the Iron Range. So I think maybe a few more jobs might bring more people, some more work up there. But I wouldn't think that there's a shortage as far as supply and demand of what's going on up there. But maybe regionally around the state, there may be a shortage of work out there for folks.
Have you offered maybe to work with the bill author to... I mean, I think it seems like the standards seem similar, but I mean, if you offered to work with the bill author to maybe get something to where everybody can agree.
Mr. Stone. Chair Hoppe, Representative Fenton. Yes, we have
This bill was introduced last year, and we have tried to work with the folks that have proposed this bill. We have not reached an agreement completely on what we like with the bill.
Mr. Snope, thank you. And I think that's one of the reasons we're here today is if we can spur some of that discussion. And I want to comment on something you said. We got to get our schools to get kids to go into the trades. When they're relentlessly telling our kids you can't be successful unless you go to college, that's just wrong. We need to be a country that makes things, and we need to especially be a state that makes things, that does things. So you're 100% right in that. Representative Howe, did you want to comment?
No.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Fenton. One of the challenges is this is an attack on labor. This is an attack, and now they've just scheduled right to work for tomorrow in GovOps, another attack on labor. If you make constant attacks on labor, there's no reason they should work with you. It makes it very clear that labor is not important. Now, these folks are professionals. They are trained to do a job, and we put consumer protections in place to make certain that Minnesotans are protected. I think that these attacks on labor are wrong, and I think that you should all vote no on this bill.
Representative Howe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will assure you that this is not the intent of the bill, is to attack labor. I will say that when we, as a building official, I go out and I don't inspect anything different from a union job to a non-union job. It's a job that there's a standard out there, and I will say that the electrical inspector that I work with, Mr. Nemeth, does it the same way. He does not care who's doing the job. There's a standard to be met, and that's what we enforce. This just allows, the reason that I brought this bill to here is because I truly believe that we need to give young people an opportunity. And they may be working for a temp agency. What this bill does is lets them come to, as a laborer, to a job and work for an electrical contractor to see this might spark the interest of them going into the electrical field. And why shouldn't those hours that they work count towards their electrical certification? That's all this bill is meant to do, is if an electrical contractor gets someone from a temp agency, that those hours that they work at that job as an electrical laborer get counted and get reported to the Department of Labor and Industry to their certification as an electrician, working to a journeyman, working to a master electrician. We're just trying to spark the interest of some young, getting those hours counted from those people that work at a temp agency. That's what we're trying to do. That's the guts of the bill.
With that, we've got a few more people on our... Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Slocum.
You're getting out of the park, Chair. Thank you. I just want to update some of you who are not on any education committees, because there's a number of you here who are not on any education committees, and you may not know, but education runs in cycles, and we are shifting from the everybody has to go to college cycle to... in high schools, beginning certifications in the trades, and also then in post-secondary, the good thing is kids can go with a cohort of people they know and get a post-secondary trades education and go right into the trades with certifications. And that's where we're moving. We've had a lot of bills presented along those lines, and that's the shift from everybody has to go to college. Yes.
Representative Slocum, thank you. That is good news. I think that's a good thing. With that, we have Mr. Brendan Cummins and Mr. Gary Thaden. If you gentlemen want to come on down. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and start whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chair, I've got a handout, and I want the record to reflect that I'm the only one who laughed at the Straczynski joke.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. We place a little bit more value on your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Gary Thaden. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the four chapters of the National Electrical Contractors Association here in the state of Minnesota. I am also an employer representative on the Minnesota Workers' Compensation Advisory Council that advises the legislature and the governor on the workers' compensation issues. I spent all morning dealing with workers' compensation, and now I'm back here again in the weeds of workers' compensation, because that's what I want to talk about today. If this bill passes, and it's signed by the governor, and goes into effect, everybody buys their workers' compensation, but it encourages deceit. You have the electrical contractor who has an EMR rate, that's experience modification rate, that's an indication of how safe you are. Owners of property want to know how safe the contractor is before they hire him. If you have an EMR rate of 1.0 or less, 0.6, 0.7, 0.8, 0.9, 1.0, that's safe. If it's bigger than 1.0, 1.5, 2.0, you're not safe. This bill would allow an unsafe employer at 1.5 to lease the employees to a brand new electrical contractor, which you can set up through the Secretary of State's website, Dolly's website. Takes you a half an hour. You set up a new contractor. You can wash that rate into 1.0 by setting up this new company. The property owner has no idea that you're an unsafe employer because you've got this new corporation at 1.0, and they think that that's whose safety program, employees, and a supervision is, instead of that unsafe employer. And so for that reason and many other reasons that Mr. Snope talked about, we oppose this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Thaden. Representative Howe.
Mr. Chair, what prevents them from doing that today?
Mr. Thaden?
Mr. Chair, Representative, right now, because they have to work for the new Shell Corporation, they would get that rate but with the owners and the employees and the program. If it's the same owner, you could have the same owner.
Representative Howe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If someone's going to set up a shell corporation, it doesn't make any difference who sets it up and shuffles the employees over. You get the same rate. So they could do that very same thing today. This bill does not change that whatsoever. You can the shell corporations get set up all the time. And they can feed those employees over there. And it's illegal.
Mr. Chair, Representative, under this bill, it would not be illegal. Under this bill, they could continue to operate for years and years and years with the lower rate because the accidents would take place over with the old contractor. Because that's who employs them. It's not the new corporation that's the employer. It's the old one.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I believe that the way this is set up, that would be under contract. And that would come into play on how that works. And if they were under contract under the new company, that would follow that. So it follows that contract.
Representative Howe, I think I know where you're going with this part and with this bill, and I think your intentions are good. Is this something you could work with Mr. Thaden and Mr. Snope on? Thank you. That's what we always like to hear. Mr. Cummings.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brendan Cummins. I'm a founding partner of Cummins & Cummins Law Firm in Minneapolis. I'm a Minnesota State Bar Association Board Certified Labor and Employment Specialist. I'm here on behalf of the IBW Minnesota State Council and IBW Local 110 to testify in opposition to the bill. In my view, this bill would pose a significant risk of increased litigation in the electrical industry. Now, we lawyers love litigation, but legislators, not as much. This bill would open the door to additional litigation under what's called the joint employer theory by allowing a licensed electrician employed by one employer to supervise an unlicensed individual employed by a different employer. Under applicable law, a contract under which an employee of one company is obligated to supervise the work of an employee of another company is likely to create a joint employer relationship. And this type of joint employer relationship expands the risk of liability and increases the likelihood that litigation will be brought against the contractor by employees of another company. Not only may it result in litigation against more companies, but also can complicate litigation by adding more parties and more discovery. Question was posed earlier about well, who's responsible for safety? Same question can be posed for other laws like discrimination laws, the labor laws. Who's responsible? When you have a joint employer relationship, you have a game of hot potato. Each employer points a finger at the other, and ultimately it results in more litigation. Sue them both is the answer frequently for a plaintiff's lawyer. The recent amendments make the bill even worse by adding staffing services into the mix, not just licensed electrical contractors. This exacerbates the problem with joint employer relationships, muddies the legal waters even more, and expands the risk of litigation. If any staffing agency can hire a licensed electrician and lend them out to supervise an unlicensed person, the joint employer problem not only becomes more legally uncertain, but also far more widespread. In addition, electrical contractors would face a greater risk of litigation, court litigation, regarding personal injuries or deaths on the job if this legislation is passed. Ordinarily, a contractor's risk of liability is limited by the workers' compensation laws, which do not permit court action, do not provide for the big-ticket items like emotional distress or punitive damages. But those restrictions will not likely protect an employer from a claim by another company's employee. Because of the limits imposed by this workers' compensation system, plaintiffs' lawyers often seek to file what are called third-party claims against other negligent actors besides the direct employer. If this bill is passed, an employer whose licensed employee supervises the work of an unlicensed worker could become a vulnerable target for such a third-party lawsuit in the event of a work-related injury to the unlicensed individual. The bottom line is that dividing responsibility between two employers, one that supervises and one that employs, is a recipe for more litigation. In order to avoid the needless cost and confusion of additional litigation in the electrical industry, please oppose this bill. Thank you.
Mr. Cummins, thank you. Representative Hilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier. So would the leased employee be employed by anyone, and then who would they be eligible for workers' compensation or unemployment benefits, and then would they be subject to the Fair Labor Standards Act? Do you know?
Mr. Cummins?
They would be employed by someone, and in all likelihood a joint employer relationship. And as to who would be providing the benefits, you know, that would be in question. Typically, it would be the direct employer, the supplier employer, in this case the licensed electrical contractor that's supplying the licensed individual. They would be providing those benefits. They would be subject to the wage and hour laws. But because of the game of hot potato, it's more difficult for someone in that scenario to enforce their rights, because the employer says, well, the employer that's actually leasing, doing the leasing, says, well, the other employer is the one that's paying you. So I'm not responsible here. I'm not your direct employer, so I don't have to comply with the wage and hour laws. And the other employer says, well, wait a minute, you're working for this other, you're leased out to this other employer. So you get this game of hot potato about liability, and this is what results in uncertainty in litigation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cummins. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to understand, first, would there be a requirement that the leased employee be employed by any company? Could there be an independent contractor have their own LLC?
Well, that depends on how the bill is drafted. As it currently stands, it refers to the employer of the leased employee. And there's a reference to that and to compliance with workers' compensation and that sort of thing. So there appears to be an expectation that they would be employed by someone. I think the likely scenario is they'd be employed by two employers.
But could they be employed by their own company, by their own LLC? I mean, is that a way that could be allowed under this as drafted? Do you understand what I'm asking?
Mr. Cummins?
You may not.
Mr. Chair, yes, I think they could be employed by their own company as long as they're complying with the workers' compensation laws and other laws.
Mr. Chair, so I guess because the concern that I have is that even without the title of an independent contractor, I guess I'd be worried that the way one direction this could go, on top of all the other concerns you've identified, is that really would it devolves responsibility and liability away from the person who actually is the has pulled the permit. and could actually have it be that there is no employer that's in fact necessary. You can set up that structure. But I also want to ask about the workers' comp piece, because if workers' comp if you have a claim that is made that arises from an injury where an employee is in a different company, I guess my question is how do you think that would end up working in this situation? Let's say there is what would be a workers' comp claim if you have an employee-employer relationship, but now you have somebody who's supervised by the employer but technically employed by somebody else. How do you expect that would work?
Mr. Chair, the way I would expect it to work is the person would file a workers' comp claim with respect to their joint employer under that policy, but a plaintiff's lawyer, enterprising plaintiff's lawyer, would look for a third-party claim potentially against the other employer.
And Mr. Chair, and are those third-party claims, are they limited in the same way that workers' comp claims are limited?
They are not.
Okay. And so, I guess, Mr. Chair, it just seems to me that this seems like a very messy situation and addressing, solving a problem that doesn't seem to exist in the first place. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. Representative Lunin.
Thank you. And this is a question for the author. Does this bill require workers' comp coverage?
Representative Howe.
Yes, it does.
Thank you, Representative Howe. Thank you, Representative Lunin. And I think one of the things that we wanted to do, the main thing, is to have this kind of a discussion. And I think it's good that we have all of this being brought up. And Representative Howe, again, knowing the intent of your bill, I think there are a lot of things there that can be worked on in language and wordsmith and things like that. With that, we got one. Representative Pinto, did you have another?
Maybe I'll just note that although it sounds like it does require workers' comp coverage, it sounds like there would not be the limitations of workers' comp coverage if you have the employee supervised by a different employer. But based on what counsel is saying, is that there would not actually be those limitations, even though there may be workers' comp coverage that is present. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pinto, I think that noise you hear is somebody scribbling down notes and noting one more thing that needs to be wordsmithed or changed. With that, we've got two more people on the list. Gentlemen, thank you very much. Doug Ruiz.
Mr. Chair, Doug is not coming. He had to go back to work and get a job.
Okay. Very nice. We like that. And then last would be Todd Green from Department of Labor and Industry. And is there anybody else while Mr. Green is coming down? Is there anybody else in the audience that wants to speak for or against the bill? Feel free if you want. Come on down. Mr. Green, welcome. Please state your name for the record and start when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Todd Green. I'm Assistant Director with the Construction Codes and Licensing Division at the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry, and I'm here today to offer comment on behalf of Commissioner Ken Peterson. Before speaking to this bill, I'd like to provide the committee members some information about the electrical stakeholders that we regulate. Some responsibilities of Construction Codes and Licensing Division include the licensing, permitting, and inspection of various construction trade professionals, including electrical, elevator, plumbing, and high-pressure pipe fitting. Today in Minnesota, there are over 2,000 licensed Class A electrical contractors, 6,000 Class A master electricians, 11,000 Class A electrical journey workers. There are also nearly 11,000 registered unlicensed individuals who assist licensed electricians while gaining the knowledge and skill necessary to become licensed journey workers. CCLD also issues over 105,000 electrical permits annually and conducts approximately 155,000 inspections statewide. On HF 2320, various groups within the electrical industry are divided on the proposed legislation before this committee today. The commissioner encourages these industry stakeholder groups to reach consensus on any proposed legislative changes. Until then, the department opposes this legislation.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Members, any questions? Not seen any. We got another testifier. Welcome to the committee.
State your
name and take your time.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Lincoln Benton, and IBW 292. I just took down some notes on my phone. I did not have paper as I was going here, so I apologize.
That's okay. I'm very tech savvy. I'm with you.
Quality deal, sir. Quality deal. Thank you very much. There are four very brief topics I want to bring up. One, safety. Safety is a thing that I don't know how many of you have worked at a temp agency. I personally have, and the safety is abysmal. And that goes across the board, and that's working in factories. I've worked at seven different factories through temp agencies. It was shocking the amount of introductory safety. Now, I'm not trying to put that on the employer. I'm trying to say that as working at the temp agency, you get dispatched, you go somewhere, and normally, like at a construction site, there's a safety training. I might have to sit for 2 hours at the start of my day, the one day of the whole job, just to get trained on how the job site works and what things to watch for. And of course, I know some of that stuff, but that's like a training thing that goes a little bit beyond what they're going to give you at a temp agency. Now, maybe some temp agencies specify more, or work specifically more with construction industry stuff, because I've worked with some of those temp agencies finding IT work. But at the same time, I don't see any temp agency is going to be able to reach the level of introductory training that we give somebody, or that any electrical contractor would give somebody before they sent them out to a job site. That's my first one, sir. I just keep going?
Cool. You're good.
All right. I wanted to point out, because I really think that it, yeah, from Greater Minnesota, I am from there. All right? I just moved to the cities here about 2 years ago, and I've been super excited to be closer to where things are. I'm super privileged to be able to get to this capital today and talk to people and have you guys listen to me. I really appreciate that. This is not an opportunity that a lot of Greater Minnesota has easily accessible, but they do have access to our jobs. I, the whole time I've worked, 14 years, I want to say, in this industry, and I lived almost that entire time out in Greater Minnesota. And you're right that it was a commute, and it was a commute that was rough, and I was privileged enough to be able to make that commute. But one of the benefits of the wage that we make as an electrical worker that could be from Greater Minnesota, is that you can travel to find that work. And I think that it was a great proposed idea that other Greater Minnesota would expand and utilize the same bench system that we have. Now, I'm part of it where I don't actually have a bench so much, so it's not the same, but we have that list. We have this phone call system where you would be like, all right, well, we know some guys that need work. We're going to bring them in. I think that's genius for them to utilize out in those areas where pulling people from the cities might be a little bit more difficult. Greater Minnesota can unionize or could use the same bench system without being unionized. I do feel like there's an extreme lack of liability. I'm not going to repeat that, though. We've heard a lot of much smarter people tell you about liability way better than I could. And I feel like that wasn't intentionally missed. I feel like his copying, it sounds like he grabbed all of the current laws that were there and put them in. I feel like that was great. Like, this is a great insight to go, okay, well, I want to make sure that these people are still liable. The problem is with this multiple contractors, it can get really sticky really fast.
And I'll just interrupt you. I think your testimony talking about liability when you do this every day, I think that carries a lot of weight with the committee. You're doing a nice job.
I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks.
Trying to keep you going.
You're a
very emotional individual. So. And last but not least, I am so happy to hear you say, and you as well, Miss, that we have got to stop this college-only thing. It is a huge burden to be putting on students when they get pushed out and they're like, hey, the only thing you can do is college. That's not true. There are so many better opportunities. And rather than just tell them, hey, you can go work at this factory or you can go work at that factory, coordinating them. And I'm not saying it always has to be a union. It doesn't always have to be through unionization, although, of course, I'm partial. But you could do that through a lot of ways of just telling people and informing them of what laws are in place. And sure, we've got it up in our stores or in our businesses and our places of employment, but to really teach that to the young people at that step is hugely important. The idea, and I don't mean to pick up on words, but the idea that you would use a temp agency to get younger workers interested in our work, I just feel like that's just not the right way to be going about it. I feel like we have a lot more opportunities to be reaching kids in high school and to reaching kids and people at a younger place. I do not disagree that I myself found some things through temp agencies, but I did not find this career. I just was really absolutely proud to have two representatives up there that were really thinking about this, because that means a lot. I've got a 16-year-old, and I feel like I'm pushing him into the trades, and I don't like that. But I'm only doing that because the school is pushing them into college. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. Good job.
Thank you.
Nice job. Thank you. Members, any questions? Seeing none, Representative Howell, do you want to make some comments?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think there's some ground to be made and some changes to be made, and I think we can do that before we hit to the next committee. But I do believe that this bill is needed. I think that we can offer good opportunities for good people, and I'll leave it at that.
Well, Representative Howell, I agree with you, and I think this is, I think it's well intentioned, and I think there is a lot of ground to be covered. I think we've had a lot of conversation from both sides. A lot of concerns have been raised by people on the committee and people that testified, and I think there's a lot of things that you have expressed willingness and others that have spoken have expressed willingness to work on. And I think at this point, and you're probably not going to like this, but I think I would change the motion. I think we'd lay this over. Let's keep it here in this committee and get it worked on, and we can work on it again another day. And with that, I think we will have House File 2320 be laid over. Thank you, members, and thank you, everybody, for a good discussion.
Representative Poppy, welcome to your committee. Would you like to move your House File 3799?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will move House File 3799, and I would also like to move a DE2 amendment.
You have an author's amendment. Is there any members? The amendment is in your packet. Are there any questions to the amendment? All those in favor of the author's DE2 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Amendment adopted. Representative Hoppe, to your bill.
Madam Chair, members, I had some remarks I was going to make, but given the hour, I will turn it over to Ms. Rowan from MITSI and Mr. Clevin from Thrivent, and they can tell you the practical application for this bill.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank
you. Please state your name for the record.
Rick Clevin. I'm Vice President of Government Affairs for Thrivent. I work in Minneapolis. Thanks for consideration here. I'll be brief. I'm going to tell you briefly kind of who we are and why we think this legislation is important, and then Robin will fill you in on kind of how it works. Thrivent is a fraternal benefit society. Other fraternals you might have heard of in Minnesota include Catholic United Financial, headquartered in St. Paul, Sons of Norway in Minneapolis. Also, a lot of you have probably heard of the Knights of Columbus. We offer life insurance and annuities to our members, but we're a very different kind of insurer. We're actually a not-for-profit group. We, by law, carry out a lot of charitable and community activities, millions of volunteer hours every year, charitable contributions, those sorts of things. We're in probably all over the state. We're membership groups. We have to have a common bond. Some of our common bonds are things like national origin or heritage. But frankly, there's a lot of Lutherans and Catholics that like their fraternals. We also are organized under a lodge system or councils. Our members are organized locally into little groups, smaller groups, to do largely community activities. Most of the laws concerning life insurance, how it's sold, market conduct, these sorts of laws apply to us as a fraternal as they do to commercial companies. But there are some exceptions or some modifications in the law to accommodate our unique structures. One of those is our solvency mechanism, and that's what we want to talk about trying to improve. Because of our unique nature and structure, for over 100 years, members of fraternals are essentially responsible for the solvency of their societies. This is something that's in the law of every state. It's required to be in our insurance contracts, in the laws of our group. Generally, this has worked well. It's rare that that sort of thing has to be invoked. And the history of solvency and fraternals taking care of fraternals is very good. But, you know, times change. And we've had a history of fraternals. If one's got a problem, another one will kind of swallow them up. There's not as many of us. We're strong, and those of us around are strong and large and successful and doing our job in communities. But it's not, as times have changed, we've noticed that some of the laws that are out there, particularly a couple of cases, the laws were inadequate. And what happens when the laws are inadequate and aren't clear, and they're not, it's hard for a regulator to know how to get through them, what happens is costs go up. There's inefficiencies, there's legal fees, there's receivership fees. and time is money, and ultimately whatever money isn't there is a loss that's borne by members. And we don't think that should happen, so we're actually proposing additional regulation. We, as the fraternals and our national trade, have come up with some laws we think will better do this, and frankly, we think that there should be less worry about maintaining a certain fraternal that might be, you know, might have been great 100 years ago, versus making sure that the consumers, the members who have insurance, are protected and that they can maintain those assets. So that's what our draft is about. That's what our bill is about. I'd say about half of the bill in front of you was passed in the state of Illinois a few years ago. Since then, we've looked and we've learned, and we found some additional improvements to make that we'd like to offer. We chose Minnesota as a key place to start because we've always worked well with the department here and with the legislature on these sorts of laws. We've got a good, healthy fraternal community. We've had a good relationship here. An example was 8 years ago, I can't believe it was that long ago, we put in place the first risk-based capital law for fraternals, kind of mirrored very similar to what happens with commercial companies, in Minnesota. And in fact, the amendments we're talking about today, in large measure, amend some of those sections. So that was a good effort. We're working on this in some other states. Some of the other states that we have a lot of fraternals in do not have a legislative session that's going to work for us. So we really appreciate the attention we're getting in Minnesota on what we think is a vital matter that will help protect consumers here and in other places.
Thank you.
And I will turn it over to Robin.
Ms. Rowan, do you have some comments to make?
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Robin Rowan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council. And I'm going to briefly talk about what the provisions of the bill before you. So basically what this bill does is it provides the Department of Commerce with more tools to deal with fraternal societies that are in trouble. And that's important because, as Rick said, it's the members of the society that are responsible for the solvency of that society. And so when fraternals are in trouble and end up being liquidated, it can be the members that end up paying the price for that. So we want to give the regulator as many tools in their toolbox to prevent that from happening. And if it does have to happen, we want it to be as efficient and as fast as possible. So there are three main points that I want to run through. The first is fraternals can assess their members if they're in financial peril. And right now they can do that without the Department of Commerce's prior approval. We want the Department of Commerce to look at an assessment and say, is this in the best interest of the members? Not, is this just in the best interest of preserving the Polish white eagles of Czechoslovakia, but is this in the best interest of the members? So that's one change we're making. The second change we're making is that fraternals have a history of taking care of other fraternals. And so we want to make it easier for fraternals to transfer policies to a healthy society. And so right now that has been done in several states, but the law doesn't give the department clear authority to do that. So we provide that authority. In addition, we also provide the authority for the department to transfer fraternal policies to a commercial insurer, if that's the only option, because all of these things are preferable to going through rehabilitation and liquidation and protecting the members. The other thing we do is we streamline the process whereby the fraternal would approve such a transfer. As Rick said, many of these are lodge systems. Sometimes their governing bodies don't meet for 4 years. So if you have a fraternal that's in trouble, waiting for 4 years is not the best idea. So it provides the ability to streamline that once a commissioner has approved a transfer. Finally, if a transfer is not possible, if there's not a merger possible, if no one is interested in helping this fraternal, the bill provides the commissioner with standards to determine whether it's better to rehabilitate the fraternal or to liquidate it. And this is important because fraternals are small, not-for-profits. We're not talking about Transamerica. There's not a lot of capital out there. People, if a fraternal didn't rescue them or a commercial didn't rescue them, it's going to be very hard to return them to long-term viability. So if you force them through liquidation, you're just spending the members' money. This happened recently in New Hampshire. In the space of 2 years, the regulator put a fraternal through rehabilitation twice. They assessed the members twice, and then they still had to liquidate the fraternal. So what we're trying to do is give the commissioner the tools to determine, is rehabilitation the right thing? And if it's not, they can go straight to liquidation. They can go straight to liquidation now, but nobody does. They tend to do rehabilitation first because that's the way it's done. But it's not always what's right. So we want the department to have standards so that they can determine what's the best thing to do in this situation. Lastly, we've been talking to the Department of Commerce about this for about 6 weeks, and we want to continue the dialogue. Solvency is a big deal. It's the most important thing they do. And we want to continue this dialogue. They want to talk to the regulators in other states. So what we're asking you to do today is to support the proposal, and we will continue to work with Commerce on it. Thank you. I'll answer any questions.
Thank you. And are there any questions for Mr. Clevin or Ms. Rowland? Mr. Brickwoody, do you want to talk, have something to say?
Madam Chair, for the record, Peter Brickwoody, Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Commerce. As Ms. Rowan indicated, an insurance company insolvency is perhaps the most serious insurance-related regulatory matter that the Commerce Department would participate in. And consequently, I think the department has some concerns about the language that's before you and the bill as amended, but understanding that the bill needs to move forward to make deadline and that we will continue the discussions with the industry that we've been having for several weeks. We want to make sure that we get this right, particularly as we've heard, this bill sort of is setting up to be a de facto national model, and if we are going to do that, we want to make sure that we don't create any unintended consequences both here in Minnesota but in any other states that might follow Minnesota's example to pass this bill later on. I take Mr. Clevin and Ms. Rowan's comments as a compliment, and we do have a small number of fraternals here in Minnesota compared to other states, but we want to make sure that we don't have any unintended consequences in how we structure a process that is specific to fraternals. But how does it actually play out, and what are the differences between the insolvency process that would occur today under current law for a fraternal versus how it would go forward? We want to make sure we get that right. So Commerce has been very candid with the industry. As Ms. Rowan indicated, we're planning to speak with regulatory colleagues from other states this weekend at the NAIC Spring National Meeting. We will be gathering feedback there, and we'll discuss with the industry. We've been very candid with the industry also about the fact that we may need to continue these discussions into the interim next year and come back next session with a bill. But we're working with them, and happy to stand with questions.
Okay. Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is a great bill, and I think we should let them get it right and vote for it.
Thank you. Okay. Are there any other questions from the members? Is there anyone else who would like to testify for or against the bill? No. Seeing none, Representative Hoppe, closing remarks.
I would tell everybody to listen to Representative Slocum.
Thank you, members. All those in favor of House, I'm sorry, Representative Hoppe removes his motion for 3799 as amended to go to the general register. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Motion
passed.
With that, members, we're adjourned.
Yay.
Good job. That's good.